before we get started, just a very quick announcement that on July 7th at noon in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I will be at the Generation Y meetup. And then on July 22nd, I will be at the Canadian True Crime Podcast live show and meetup held in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Information on both of these events will be in the show notes. It was a Friday evening in Kansas City when the lives of two families changed through the choices of one man. Christopher DeBow called 911 to report the shooting of Sherelle Collins. DeBow claimed Collins had brought a gun into his home, there was a fight, and DeBow killed Collins in self-defense. So on this night, two families had their lives changed through the actions of one man. But the question a jury would be asked to decide 8 months later was which man's actions led to the death of Mr. Collins. I recently invited one of those jurors, Amber, over to discuss jury service, the trial, and the things she didn't expect, like how when a jury makes their decision, they can't always account for all the consequences of that decision. I'm Charlie, and this is a mini, mid-break, I can't seem to stay away from podcasting episode of Impact Statement. When a crime ends in a conviction, the victims or their families are often allowed to give a statement to the court about the impact of the crime on their lives. But when these life-altering events go unsolved, do not end in a conviction, or maybe aren't crimes at all, the victims and their families do not have this opportunity. The stories on this podcast are their impact statements. What happened in a South Kansas City duplex on a warm Midwestern September evening became a question for a jury. According to Christopher DeBow, a man named Sherelle David Collins had been harassing him for some time. This is Amber, a juror in the trial that was to come.
His claim was that he was at home and he heard this banging and banging on the door, that he knew who it was, but he went down to check on his dogs. And at that time, this man burst into his home with a gun, that they fought. He wrestled the gun away and shot the man and killed him. But it was in self-defense, because after he shot him, he went outside and he called 911 and said, there's been a fight. But he never denied that he did shoot Mr. Collins, the victim.
The 911 call was placed at 6:30 p.m., and when authorities arrived, they found DeBow standing on his porch. He directed them to where Sherelle Collins was seated on the couch, having been shot multiple times. He died at the scene. DeBow initially waived his Miranda rights and told police that he had shot the victim. DeBow had recently gotten out of a stint in state prison, and he suspected that Collins had been having a relationship with his wife while he was behind bars. He told police that Collins came to his house uninvited, but then he decided he would like to speak to an attorney, and a public defender was assigned to his case. DeBow was charged with first-degree murder and armed criminal action. Unable to make bond, he was imprisoned until trial. All jury trials start with jury selection. In this case, of a pool of 60 jurors, only 14 would be chosen. 12 jurors and two alternates, ready to step in if one of the 12 could not finish the trial. Those who listen to true crime podcasts know the term voir dire. Voir dire is the process by which attorneys question potential jurors, looking for a bias or for information that would make them good or bad jurors. Of course, in our adversarial system, what the prosecutor and what the defense counsel are looking for may not be the same things. Here is Amber.
When the judge addressed us, he said, "I just want you to know, if you don't say anything, you're more likely to be selected. So it's worth your while to speak up and be honest. So the questions that they asked were things like, do you have any relationship to law enforcement? Do you have any negative experience with law enforcement? Have you had anyone in your family be a victim of crime? Well, none of these things applied to me. And I think even, and I'm trying to even remember what they asked, but I never did feel strongly about anything enough to speak up about it. For example, there was a man that spoke up when they said, do you have negative experience with law enforcement? He said, I'm a black man from Arkansas in my 50s. What do you think? You know, he was not chosen. They asked, one question was, does anyone here want to be on the jury? And one woman said, yes, I would really like the opportunity to serve. I'm interested. And she was also not chosen. For us, we did not get to be privy to who was being struck and why. We didn't hear anything. That was all done out of our range. But in the end, the only thing I did say, I think they asked us, do you have questions for us? And I just said, is this a death penalty case? Because I am opposed to the death penalty. And they said, no, it is not a capital murder case. They let us know the charge was first degree murder.
Another question asked was about crime scene photographs. In order for the state to make their case that this was not self-defense, the position of the victim on the couch and in relation to the rest of the home was important. Photographs would be seen, and jurors who said they were not able to handle them were dismissed. In this particular case, Amber didn't find them too graphic.
During the course of the trial, we did see pictures of the victim. When he was shot, he was shot on and was on the sofa in the home. And so that one that we saw where it was him completely, it was a white T-shirt or like white with print, and it was just covered in blood. You didn't see a whole lot. I think his head was back. It really wasn't terribly troubling to me anyway. But then also there were some autopsy photos that showed the gunshot wounds, the entry and exit type of wounds. But again, that was just a very small portion of skin, and it didn't bother me.
The prosecution's case was largely aimed to disprove the self-defense claim. Missouri has had, since 2007, a castle doctrine. This law allows people to defend their homes against intruders, even if that includes deadly force. Prosecutors had to prove that not only was there not a violent struggle in the home, like the defendant claimed, they had to convince the jury that Collins had been invited into the home. On the other side, the defense argued that he was not invited, but rather banged on the door and entered the home forcefully. For the defense, DeBow took the stand to explain what happened. While a defendant never has to take the stand in his own defense, DeBow's defense was that it happened differently than the state's theory of the case, but he was the only witness to the events. The only effective way to present this affirmative defense to the jury was for him to take the stand.
He was very open about the fact that he shot Mr. Collins. But then when the forensic evidence came up, if they tried to question him about it, he just told us, you know, it happened the way that he said, and, you know, that was that he couldn't explain it. The evidence on the other side was pretty clear that it did. We knew that it didn't happen the way that he said it happened.
The defendant claimed the victim brought the gun to the scene, but this is impossible to know. Missouri does not require a license to own a gun. It does not require guns to be registered. And if the gun sale happens between private citizens, Missouri does not require a background check or for any paperwork to be filed. A large number of guns that are lawfully owned in Missouri are untraceable. Under the Castle Doctrine, Christopher DeBow could have been found not guilty if the jury believed Sherelle Collins barged into his home. The jury was also open to consider a lesser charge, because in Missouri, even if a defendant is charged with first-degree murder, that is the intentional and premeditated killing of another person, the jury can consider second-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, or involuntary manslaughter. As DeBow testified that he did shoot and kill the victim, and the jury rejected his explanation of self-defense, the question the jury wrestled with was the question of premeditation. Premeditation does not necessarily mean that the defendant lured the victim to his home with a plan to murder him. Premeditation can happen within moments. The time between forming the intent to kill and acting on it only needs to be enough time for a reasonable person to have second-guessed the decision. The jury was faced with deciding if they believed DeBow had taken the time to consider his actions prior to pulling that trigger. One thing the jurors were not given in the trial was the motive. It was only after the trial that Amber learned that the men had a long-standing dislike for each other, and that DeBow suspected Collins of sleeping with his wife. This information, as well as an alleged connection the men had through illegal dogfighting, was not allowed in the trial. After 4 hours of deliberation, the jury returned with a guilty verdict for first-degree murder.
It was the way that the victim was seated on the sofa in his home. He made it sound like there was this scuffle, and they fought, and then he shot the guy, and the guy fell back. But if I remember correctly, there were bullets in the sofa, like it penetrated it. There was a tiny space. It was like a duplex, and they gave us the layout. It was such a small area, and there was a fan, like, within feet of where he claimed that this fight would take place, but yet nothing was disturbed. It was all kinds of things, like the angle, the way it seemed like he had shot the victim while the guy was seated. There was no blood anywhere else. Nothing was knocked over, nothing like that. In addition, we talked about the gun itself. The defendant said that he took this gun from the victim. However, they did some analysis of it, and they found, I think, palm prints and fingerprints from the defendant, but nothing at all from the victim. And that was a question in our minds at the end, was where did the gun come from? Because it didn't seem to be something that he had in his possession before. We're not sure exactly, you know, where he got it. It felt like this was planned. And compared to second-degree murder, which the judge later described to us after the trial as something like a drive-by shooting, because that was one of the questions that we had during deliberation. What is the difference? When we asked, he came back to refer to the jury instructions. And so that was really where we spent the time deciding. It felt like it was very much an intentional thing, but how planned was it? And really, the evidence suggested to us that this man came into his home invited, that the way he was shot was planned out.
The jury did not take their duty lightly. Though they had to take a dispassionate look at the facts to render a fair and just verdict, that doesn't mean they didn't feel the weight of that decision.
Through all of it, yes, I think I can be fair as I'm weighing the evidence and making the decision. But that felt so detached from the reality of this person in front of us and the victim who's not there to speak for himself, and how important what we were doing was for these people's lives. We all from the beginning felt like, yes, this was intentional, but what charge are we going to convict on? We had a couple people who were very vocal and were, I think, to their credit, very deliberate about, like, okay, well, I don't know about first-degree murder. Can we talk through these other possibilities? It never got heated. It was a really rational kind of conversation. It feels very insular while you're there. It's occupying most of your time, your thoughts. You know, I tell my husband everything, and I couldn't tell him anything about it while it was going on. So that, the emotional turmoil of that was very difficult.
After the verdict, Christopher DeBow appealed his conviction based on errors in the trial and ineffective assistance of counsel. I asked Amber her view of his defense.
I don't know that there was a whole lot that they could do to defend him because he claimed that it was in self-defense. You know, there wasn't a whole lot to refute other than the circumstances of this man arriving in his home. I felt like the defense team's argument was a lot more on the emotional side. How would you feel if someone came into your home with a gun? What would you do? But there really wasn't a whole lot more for them to go on than what he'd said.
But you have to wonder, if DeBow didn't need to rely on an overburdened public defender, and if he could afford an attorney and experts to examine the evidence like we see in higher profile cases, could he have challenged some of the forensic evidence that was used to convict him? Christopher DeBow's appeal would never be heard. 6 months after the trial, DeBow was in a prison day room when another inmate, Lawrence W. Logan, stabbed him to death. Logan was serving a life sentence with the possibility of parole for second-degree murder. He was found in the prison bathroom with blood on his clothes and a bloody shiv. He was initially charged with first-degree murder, which was then changed to second-degree murder. He later pled guilty. He was then sentenced to 30 years to run consecutively with the sentence he was already serving. Logan did not give a motive in the murder of DeBow. Of course, when the jury sentenced Christopher DeBow to spend the rest of his life in jail, they didn't imagine it would be cut short 6 months later. Amber says she was saddened to hear about Christopher DeBow's death in prison. Though she doesn't have any doubts about his guilt, she hates that he was turned over to such a broken system that so quickly led to his murder. Just as she felt after the verdict, it just seems like everyone loses. If you are interested in sharing your story on Impact Statement, please email impactstatementpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter at statementpod. Impact Statement is now on Patreon to help defray some of the production costs, such as transcription services and hosting fees. If you'd like to donate to the show, go to patreon.com and search for Impact Statement. On the next Impact Statement.
A lot of kids, you know, they'll smoke cigarettes, they'll experiment with alcohol or drugs every once in a while, and, you know, become sexually active too young. And, I mean, that's just what kids do. You know, I do believe that I probably could have bounced back from that like the majority of kids do. But the trauma for my mom and Greg's death really just, it just planted really deep inside me, and it started to take roots in there that I wasn't really even aware of until much, much later.